Hello everyone, I am Shahid Jurayev at Crossroads Central Asia. This is the second episode of our podcast on politics and international relations in Central Asia. Dr. Eric McGlinchey of George Mason University will be hosting the discussion with today's guest, Dr. Andrew Cutchins from American University of Central Asia. The podcast is supported by the Holding Center for International Dialogue.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us. We're very pleased today to have with us Dr. Andrew Cutchins. As many of you know, in fact, probably all of you know, Andrew Cutchins is the president of American University of Central Asia. And today we are going to be focusing on, among other things, the impact of COVID-19 on politics in Eurasia, in Kyrgyzstan, also potentially a little bit in the United States. We'll be talking about political transition or change in regimes, which is interesting as we have change going on both in Kyrgyzstan and the United States. So one of the questions we'll be looking at is the potential impact on bilateral relations between these two countries. Lastly, I think we'll be potentially looking at what's next for Kyrgyzstan as the presidential elections are approaching. So with that, I wanted to just say welcome, Andy. We're very grateful that you're joining us today. Let's get to that first question about COVID-19, and perhaps starting with what's been the impact on COVID-19 in your day-to-day experience at American University of Central Asia?
Well, thanks, Eric. Sharbek, it's great to be with you guys. Well, the first impact, of course, goes back to the middle of March when, like most universities and colleges around the world, we went fully online, and that went reasonably well. Trying to do budget planning was a real challenge in May and June, but actually we did really well with our recruiting for the fall and also with our retention of students. So that was a big plus. And from the COVID standpoint, things have gone, we're doing online better this fall than we did in the spring. So that's all good. But from the university standpoint, just starting with that, where we are getting hit is in increasing debt of tuition payments by students and families. And that's been growing ever since March when COVID hit, and the economic impact fallout from COVID has been very significant. And of course, the political instability that has taken place this fall doesn't help things. The COVID numbers here have risen to the level about 500 to 600 a day where they were in early August. They had a horrible peak in the second half of July where it got to be around 1,000 a day. But, if you're not tested, you're not infected. So the numbers were much greater, and there was a sense that almost everybody, someone in everybody's family was getting sick. We had at the university at one time in July, 20% of our faculty and staff were sick from COVID. Fortunately, nobody died, but it was a very, very difficult time. And my view, if we kind of switch this to politics, is that, well, I think 2020 is a bad year for incumbent politicians, probably anywhere around the world. That may have been the decisive factor in Mr. Trump not getting reelected, although I didn't expect it would be quite as close as it was. But I think especially for Kyrgyzstan, what happened in July, it really was kind of catastrophic. And it was an exposure of institutional breakdown of the government and inability to provide the kind of help that people needed. The medical system was overwhelmed. And it was civil society, actually, people going out and finding ways to get medicines back to Kyrgyzstan and certain pieces of equipment. It was an impressive show of civil society, actually, here. But that and the economy together left people in a much sourer mood coming into the parliamentary elections on October 4th. I think having the 7% barrier to entry for parties was a problem. Because what you ended up with was only four parties making it into parliament, and three of them were basically pro-Vlast, pro-government parties, more or less. And with 57, 58% of the vote, they got close to 90% of the seats. If more opposition parties had gotten into the parliament, we wouldn't have seen what we had seen. And again, I think maybe if there hadn't been COVID and the exposure of the ineptness of the Kyrgyz government and medical system, we may not have seen what we saw.
And yeah, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the role of civil society in dealing with COVID-19. For me, watching from afar, this has actually been something that's been a real bright light with Kyrgyzstan amidst, as you just described, many challenges. So I wonder if you could, one, tell us a little bit more about the volunteer brigades that seem to have kept the country afloat during this period. And then with the understanding that some of our readers may not, our listeners may not be following Kyrgyzstan as closely as you and Shire do, what happened in the summertime? I mean, again, watching from afar, it's just dumbfounding for me to see the Kyrgyz government go on vacation in the middle of a pandemic. How is that even possible? So this complete abrogation of authority at the height of a pandemic, and then civil society stepping in. If you could give us a little bit more background about how these kind of tendencies work in Kyrgyzstan, I think that would be really helpful for our listeners.
Well, I'll just say a couple of things, but leave it really to Shire to say more, because unfortunately, I was ended up locked out of the country from the middle of March until August 21st. Planned for a 1-week trip to Australia to visit my sister through Moscow, and ended up 3.5 months in Moscow and almost 2 months in the United States. That was kind of my COVID story. So I wasn't here on the ground. So that's a big caveat. But I know that several of our board members who are, active figures in Kyrgyz society took it upon themselves with their own financial means and then connections to order medicine, equipment to get into the country. Hospitals were basically turning people away. Medicine was not available. So it was people that were relying more on their own personal networks, I think, and much less so than existing health system. So I would be interested to hear Shire's perspective from being here actually on the ground.
Well, it so happened that in July, I left Bishkek for the village till I missed this peak in Bishkek. But the first thing is that indeed the July, the horrible months, COVID-wise, touched Bishkek, the city. While in rural areas, the figures were much less so, and people were not suffering as they are doing now. The second wave is hitting very hardly the rural areas. We hear from Osh, from Jalalabad, from Batken about the hospitals filled up with no places, with a shortage of medicines, shortage of doctors. So I think it was partly because it was Bishkek in July that we realized how powerful the civil society is in Kyrgyzstan. With the usage of social media, people were able to organize to help people who were just sitting, staying in their apartments, unable to dial in and invite their doctors. And probably this is a typical thing that you would expect in a country where the public institutions are very weak and people do not really expect much from public hospitals. They turn to relatives, they turn to family members, they turn to people who they know. And the government was simply not able to do anything because of the ineptness, because of corruption, and because of complete lack of competence and lack of resources. Now we're having the second wave, but as in all other countries, this period, this wave is proving to be less lethal, apparently, for some reason, at least so far. So the government is somewhat surviving with the new president or new leader not even mentioning coronavirus in his speech.
One of the frequent claims that President Trump has made here in the United States is you can't let the response to coronavirus be more harmful than the virus itself. As much as I personally may disagree with a lot of President Trump's policies, there is, I think, the question that we have to ask ourselves, and I think it's even more important in an economy like Kyrgyzstan. I mean, is there some justification to that argument that that Kyrgyzstan just can't survive a lockdown, particularly as we're looking to the winter when cases are going to be going up? Would a lockdown and the economic devastation that would impose on the economy be, in fact, more painful than dealing with coronavirus and the impact coronavirus has on the healthcare system and people's health broadly?
We have to all remember, and for our listeners, you know, that Kyrgyzstan is a poor country. Per capita income of less than $2,000 per annum. So the margins, the economic margins, are very thin for families, the great majority of families surviving, let alone thriving. You know, I felt from the beginning, kind of worldwide, that some countries were facing the choice of, well, are you going to kill the economy or are you going to kill more people? And that's really getting between a rock and a hard place. It's not a kind of place where you want to have to make that decision. It was really interesting in that in the first two, maybe even 3 months of the pandemic, Kyrgyzstan was doing really well relatively with numbers, and then suddenly they weren't, and it had to do with the not only, you know, calling off the lockdown. Again, I was not here personally, but I think that, you know, people were just not wearing masks as much as they should. They weren't washing their hands as much as they should. They weren't social distancing as they should. And they got hammered. And certainly the current leadership, acting president, prime minister, he would be very, very loath to call for a lockdown at this point. One, because there's going to be a presidential election on January 10th, and the campaign starts on December 10th, pretty soon. And the economy is already in a very bad place. You know, I think best case scenario, you're looking at a minus 5% drop in 2020. Worst case, somewhere eight to ten. So I think he's going to be reluctant to call for the lockdown unless the numbers suddenly pop up, you know, into the 1,000 or above level.
I think there's quite a large consensus in Kyrgyzstan about the lockdown. Despite the figures in July, I think it was a period when there was no effective lockdown measure. All of that was in April and March. And now, indeed, many people rely on informal jobs, day-to-day jobs, and the government doesn't have any fiscal buffer to help out the families in need compared to neighboring countries, Uzbekistan or Kazakhstan. I don't think that another lockdown is likely unless a real disaster comes, indeed.
Another, to add to that, there's the problem of, you know, most countries and multilateral institutions don't really recognize this existing government, which gets... It can be very problematic for the provision, for their provision of humanitarian or economic assistance in the near term. So I think that Kyrgyzstan is going to be relatively more alone in that regard than they were in the summertime. Some of that legitimacy may start to come back after the presidential election on January 10th.
You kind of raise the counterfactual when we first started talking about COVID-19 and this just not being a good year for leaders, you know, were it not for coronavirus, that perhaps we might not have seen the political events that we saw in the fall in Kyrgyzstan. And I want to press you on that just a little bit. It's a fairly frequent occurrence in Kyrgyzstan that when we see massive vote rigging, like we appear to have seen in the last parliamentary election in Kyrgyzstan, that we see responses similar to what we saw in the fall in Kyrgyzstan. So it is impossible for us as analysts to actually determine what the causal mechanism here is. But I'm just wondering what you guys think would have been the response in the absence of COVID-19 to the kind of election manipulations that we did see with the parliamentary ballot.
I would leave that to Shahir. This is the only election that I've been a witness of here in Kyrgyzstan. So I can't really, I have no way to speak to whether there was a greater vote buying, greater falsification and violations of the process than in other cases. That certainly seems to be the conventional wisdom that people say, but let's hear what Shire has to say.
Well, my impression is that the vote buying has always used to take place. This year, it was much more mass scale, and that's one thing. And second, even without COVID, I think the political events were developing in this direction, and the key enabler factor was deliberate effort of the President Jeenbekov and his team to centralize the control over the key political groups. Even with 2015 elections, when Atambayev effectively controlled the parliament, effectively controlled four or five parties within the parliament, still the parties made into parliament in a more or less free elections, even though everyone was buying their votes, those who could. There was no general understanding that all of these parties would be dummy parties for the president. Here, everything was just blatantly explicit. There is Jeenbekov's party and there is Matraimov's party, and two of them are allies. They're just massively buying out. And both 2005 and 2010 regime changes happened in the context when the incumbent was overstepping everything in an effort to create very centralized, very controlled political elite in his hands. So I wouldn't say that the COVID played a crucial role. The President Jeenbekov's legitimacy was very weak to begin with. It was just amazing to see how protesters went to attack the government. And the simple fact that the building was taken meant that the government collapsed and there was it was basically a political capitulation of the regime. I don't think that so easily the power could be grabbed in other countries.
It reminded me of what Vladimir Lenin said in 1917. You know, power was lying in the street and we took it. And in this case, it was Japarov and his people that took it. But to add to the argument that would support, I think, the premise of your question, Eric, the corruption question was really front and center going back to early December of 2019, when there were two anti-corruption meetings really focused on Raim Matraimov, the former number two guy in the customs bureau, the Kloop and other publications, revelations that he and his cronies had amassed $700 million plus while he was in power, basically managing trade from China through Kyrgyzstan to Uzbekistan. So when you got to having his party and Begum Dik, the sort of party of power, so that I think the anti-corruption and the weakness of the president were both already well evident. And you know, the president and the government basically disappeared early on in the COVID, and the president disappeared for first 4 days of the revolution before he suddenly came out on Friday afternoon, October 9th at about 4 o'clock, and announced martial law. The other thing that I would say about the election that was seemed strange to me is that there were so many parties. You know, there were 16 parties total. I am sure that even with the 65% of the vote that was taken by the four parties that made it into the parliament, there's still 35% of the votes out there. And so if there are less parties competing for it, then likely one, maybe two more opposition-like parties get into the parliament. And then it does look differently. But that then gets to the problem of, you know, parties are very weak, and the negotiation that goes on between those with money and those that are making the party and who gets on the list and where they are on the list, there's not reliable polling. That I don't think that anybody really has on what these, you know, parties can do and what they can bring to the table. They need a better developed party system, and so that there's a little more certainty about what you're signing on to, because it seems like these are very difficult calls to make. And for those that want to be high on the party list, you know, you're talking about the investment of several hundred thousand dollars. And that is not only about you, It's about not only about your family, but it's about your sort of your larger extended family that you represent. So there maybe the stakes are almost too high for getting into or not getting into the parliament that makes it a more risky, unstable situation.
So what you're saying, if I understand correctly, Andrew, is you think the actual kind of backroom politics of what's involved with the party lists in Kyrgyzstan are having a potentially negative and very consequential effect on not only just transparency, but the health of Kyrgyz democracy, which kind of, you know, it raises a question. The current Kyrgyz political system, not to diminish at any, you know, any respect the agency of Kyrgyz politicians and bureaucrats themselves, but also has been very heavily influenced by international donors and international advisors. You know, this was a 7% barrier to getting into parliament, the party list system, the whole parliamentary system, which kind of raises this issue about whether or not there's any degree of international culpability with the degree of instability that we see in Kyrgyzstan. Shire, since you've got the long view of this, I mean, to what extent are countries like the United States or the European Union, these international advisors, at least part responsible for the pathologies of instability that we see in Kyrgyzstan today?
I don't think there is a direct answer possible here. As a citizen of Kyrgyzstan, I would say that the responsibility is on those who implement, on those who relate, on those who invite the international advisors and their grants and monies. So I wouldn't move the responsibility to those who come and advise. I don't think there is anything problematic with the parliamentary system or the political party-based elections. Many governments, many countries are moving actually in this direction, while we think that this is a problematic one for us. Everything comes down to implementation. We haven't mastered conducting free and fair elections, and that's not a problem of international donors or foreign partners who advise Kyrgyz government, Kyrgyz political elites. This is about political struggle and the level of corruption allowed and thriving in the country. Yeah? The closed party list system is problematic, but this is done not on the advice from outside, but by those who were drafting the constitution. They had huge freedom in terms of designing more appropriate way of how the parties would make into parliament. So they chose opaque, potentially corrupt system where the citizens would have no idea who are they voting for, because the people would just withdraw from the party lists on their own without any accountability, and some random people from the down of the list end up in the parliament. This created a system where the people started questioning party systems, just another opportunity for corrupt people who don't represent the population. They end up in the parliament. They're just businessmen. The party is nothing more than a business tool. So it is about the Kyrgyz political system and Kyrgyz political leadership who discredited it really seriously.
You know, one of the reasons why we know about some of these challenges in the Kyrgyz political system is because in Kyrgyzstan, in contrast to, say, a place like Uzbekistan or even Kazakhstan, there has been a relatively vibrant and free news system, right? That the press is much more developed here than it is elsewhere. One of the things watching from afar that has me quite concerned has been the recent attacks of Dipar on the free media, his recent statements. So, you know, going forward, to draw a parallel with the U.S. system, I mean, one of the struggles that we're facing here in the United States right now is even with comparably well-structured and institutionalized electoral system here in the United States, we still see people beginning to question the results, not even beginning, really questioning the results because of the manipulation in the news media that we see with the current Trump administration. So looking forward to January with Jafar's ongoing attack on Azatik, for example, I think he's going after Kloop as well. You know, what is the likelihood of having any kind of free and fair election at the presidential level if the Kyrgyz media continues to endure the kind of attacks that we're seeing with the current interim administration?
One question to me, Eric, is, you know, who is actually going to step up and run against Mr. Chapatov? It was quite striking how quickly people were stepping aside. The Speaker of the Parliament, who should have assumed the position of acting president, but he stepped aside. Mr. Zhenenbekov himself basically decided to step down. So even not even taking into account what the current government will do vis-a-vis the press, there's still a strong feeling of I think a fear amongst people about this guy and what happened. And it really was a pretty bizarre story. You know, of the four people that were let out of jail on July 6th, former president and two former prime ministers, I don't think that anyone was thinking, you know, that he was going to be the guy that in nine days was going to be not only premier, but acting president. And then also, I think, and this is to the credit of Kyrgyz people, what was nice or good, I can't call this a revolution. To me, it's a coup d'etat. But, you know, compared to 2005, 2010, there was almost no bloodshed. And also there was almost no looting, much less immediate commercial damage. So that was a plus. And just another really positive thing that was happening during the week, you know, from October 5 on was, and this is civil society in action again, was the formation of the civil militia patrols of the Druzhniki, well, especially in Bishkek, which was quite really, really impressive. And also, I felt that one of the reasons why whoever it was that made the decision on October 9th to shut things down felt to me like the tide was turning in the favor of civil society and of those that were more reform oriented. But then that just poof went away.
So, I mean, what you're talking about, despite the positive aspects of civil society that you were suggesting, the other part to me I find terrifying, right? Which is somehow Chapatov, who was just in jail, is now running the country. Although I guess he had been increasing very prominently, like his social media presence. So, I mean, he was out there, but absolutely he was right in jail. Right.
Somebody had a plan. Yeah. On that social media campaign.
Yeah.
Made overnight. Right.
Yeah. Is this just the consolidation of thug politics, mafia politics in Kyrgyzstan? What you just described, frankly, terrifying, because in every single previous transfer of power, and I called 2010 a putsch. I didn't go so far as to call it a coup d'etat, but I was very hesitant to use the term revolution in that case. But in every single previous transfer of power, we have had an opposition. And what you're describing is basically an uncontested presidential election in January and the wholesale disappearance of any viable political. I mean, Babanov just threw his hat in the ring. Is this the consolidation of mafia rule in Kyrgyzstan and the days of democracy are over?
Well, I would say today things are not looking good. In review of what happened, yeah, this is a step backwards, I think, for democracy or at least pluralism in Kyrgyzstan. I think it's a big question mark. It's a big question mark. Remains to be seen to what extent there will actually be a consolidation. What do you think, Shire?
Well, first, I think there will be contestation. Adhan Madumarov announced that there are already 19 or 18 applicants. And of course, we know that most of them are usual suspects who end up with 0.5%. However, really, the difference is that we have not as rich choice as we used to have in the past presidential elections. And I think that tells a story of, first, the Kyrgyz political elite is learning that politics is a risky business. And as of now, we have almost no politician who hasn't been in jail. And the way how Babanov stopped playing politics and joined Sadr Japarov, I think, is a primary example of his strategy to avoid the fate of political losers in Kyrgyzstan. I think over time, once Sadr Japarov ended up being the chief leader of politics, whatever hats he has now. Political elite now started already understanding that he's the chief patron and you don't want to go against him. We will have Adahan Madumarov as of now as his primary opponent. Sadir Japarov and Madumarov are equally nationalistic populist leaders, which basically makes a non-choice. This basically also brings back to Eric's question of, is it the consolidation of a mafia politics? Sadir Japarov indeed is a very strange phenomenon. The way how he hijacked the streets in October was thanks to his aggressive crowd of supporters. They were much more aggressive and much more loyal and probably much better prepared physically and logistically than the rest. At the same time, it has been not only the aggressiveness of his supporters, but also his nationalist populist rhetoric makes him genuinely popular. We can't discount him as a marginal political figure who suddenly ended up the number one politician. This is basically a crisis of political system. This is the way how Trump emerged, unlikely president 4 years ago. And I think many people saw it as the crisis of the political establishment in general. What we took for granted apparently wasn't as solid as we thought. And in Kyrgyzstan, I think we are moving towards this more populist politics. When the votes started counting, elections are becoming more meaningful than 15 or 20 years ago. I think this inevitably, the Kyrgyz politics will be moving towards more aggressive and less politically correct leaders. And Sadir Japarov is a primary example of this.
And this is a global trend. I mean, this is not only with Kyrgyzstan where this is happening. This is happening many places all over the world. And certainly, I think the increasing nationalist tendencies and less tolerance for certain minority groups, it resonates. But I think, like Joe Biden, when he is inaugurated in January 20th, I think, assuming Mr. Japarov is elected on January 10th, they're going to be inheriting a very, 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 very challenging social, medical, political environment. And then they're going to be judged more on performance. Like I said, I think it remains to be seen to what extent there'll be a real consolidation around this. I think it's, 2021, certainly the first half of it is not going to be easy. So maybe if we might be in a better position to judge, let's say, if they actually do hold the parliamentary elections in June and see what happens. But I think we need to fasten our seatbelts for a pretty rocky ride for the next, at least the next couple of months here.
I think that's a really important observation, Andy, because I remember, the early days of the Bakiyev government and just how powerful this government seemed at the time. And ultimately, it was the failure to perform, really, that led to this government's undoing. So although it may seem, the Japarov may seem very powerful at the outset or right now when he doesn't really hold, or he's not responsible, I guess, at this point for delivering the goods. Whereas once he's elected, he will be responsible. And Kyrgyz society, civil society has not been kind to administrations that have not performed well. So I think that's a critically important observation and it provides an upbeat take on my very downbeat framing of the triumph of mafia politics in Kyrgyzstan. I think that's absolutely right. And maybe this is moving towards a wrap-up question, but you were mentioning the role of populism. You were mentioning the role of growing nationalism in Kyrgyzstan. Of course, this is a dynamic that's all over the world at this point. Kyrgyzstan has had this history, a very trying history of ethnic conflict, devastating history of ethnic conflict in 1990 and 2010, but also just low-grade conflicts since then. What is the role of an institution like AUCA that comes in, admittedly, as we were talking about earlier, with this perception of being the American University of Central Asia, right? Of an agenda, which of course is probably a mistaken perception, but one that nevertheless exists. What can AUCA do in this climate of growing nationalism, growing populism, to be a constructive force in advancing democracy, advancing pluralism, advancing freedom of press in Kyrgyzstan?
A great question. you know, we are the best university in Kyrgyzstan, arguably more widely in Central Asia. So I think we continue to do what we do and to try to do it better, and also to and have that and to be a little bit more proactive in conveying that message to the outside world. Secondly, you know, we are quite active with you know, civic engagement, but I think we need to do more than we did, and especially in Bishkek. We just ran a project, for example, a small project for a week of online training for faculty in six regional universities, all outside of Bishkek. And I was participating in the final session, the awarding of the certificates and the discussion. And I thought, you know, this is where we have got to be more active and to be doing what we can to raise the level of higher education in the country, and to be viewed as helping to do that. We just celebrated our 25th anniversary last year. And when, you know, we're looking at, you know, 25, 50 years coming on, this has got to be one of the best assistance projects that, you know, the U.S. government has been involved in. It's not all a U.S. government project, but, you know, kind of thinking from the collapse of the Soviet Union, you know, what if you build an institution that lasts for this long and has this quality and connections, sure wish we were thinking more about in making that kind of investment in the early and mid 1990s than we did.
25 years. That's congratulations. It's been wonderful to see the institution not only endure but thrive. I remember AUCA in the early days, and AUCA today, and just the human capital, to say nothing of the actual physical capital, but the human capital has grown around the institution. And if you look at alumni, the influence that AUCA has had, and I think in a very positive direction, is immeasurable and for Kyrgyzstan. So that's a wonderful achievement. So congratulations on 25 years, and I hope with the new administration that knock on wood will be installed on January 20th here in the United States. There are even brighter days to come.
Thanks, Eric. It's really been fun talking with you and Shar this evening.
Good luck, guys. Thank you.